exists in the area, and there are grievances within the tribal groups and also the Islamic community against the central government.
Criminal gangs, locally called bandits, have been operating in northwestern Nigeria for more than a decade. But when they were reportedly infiltrated by members of the Takfiri terrorist group Boko Haram in December, the abductions and violence escalated. A parent whose child was killed by kidnappers is urging the government to take action.
Government should be proactive. They should not just keep quiet. They should be proactive to help the situation because it's getting out of hand.
Now, Mr. Corrigan, do you think the criminals engaged in kidnapping of school children in Nigeria are collaborating with Boko Haram and other Takfiri terrorist groups?
Some definitely are. Some are independent operators. And, of course, there are factions within Boko Haram itself, which some of which are out of control. But Boko Haram started when the government killed a leader of the Islamic community back in 2009, and that sort of sparked the insurgency in northeast Niger and Nigeria, and also the border area of Niger. So you have 40,000 killed, 2 million people are displaced, and you have a very serious problem. So Boko Haram is doing this to generate money and also to gather followers, or trying to probably recruit child soldiers. But the main purpose seems to be to get ransom and money, which both would fund terrorism but also criminal activities.
This mass kidnapping of Nigerian school children points to major security challenges in Africa's most populous nation, amid concerns that the increasing number of students not reporting to school due to insecurity will result in a lost generation of youth. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has on several occasions said his government is working hard to restore security.
The law enforcement agencies are working hard to regain confidence against the bandits so that people can go back to the land. This is very important. This is what the law enforcement agents are very busy about now. The rainy season is coming, so we want people to go back to the land.
How is the Nigerian government responding to the current crisis? Is the situation spiraling out of control?
Questions as to where they're getting their funding, where they're getting their arms. Are there external groups, supporting them? Because, of course, Nigeria is a oil-rich country, and it's peculiar that Islamic State has been used by various outside parties to undermine central government authority, and that raises questions of, are there external actors using Boko Haram and other Islamic militant groups to accomplish other objectives and to create chaos, and of course to extort concessions from the central government.
Nigeria is an oil and gas rich nation. It is also the largest economy in Africa in terms of nominal GDP, and the 26th in the world, according to the IMF World Economic Outlook. So in whose interests is the instability in Nigeria? Now, Mr. Corrigan, our last question to you. Do you think foreign powers or entities are involved in the protracted violence and insecurity in Nigeria by backing Takfiri terrorist groups and other criminal gangs?
Questions as to where they're getting their funding, where they're getting their arms. Are there external groups, supporting them? Because, of course, Nigeria is a oil-rich country, and it's peculiar that Islamic State has been used by various outside parties to undermine central government authority, and that raises questions of, are there external actors using Boko Haram and other Islamic militant groups to accomplish other objectives and to create chaos, and of course to extort concessions from the central government.
Well, thanks for your time and insight, Mr. Corrigan. Now, we all look forward to a peaceful Nigeria where children feel safe at school and hopeful about their future. That wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know what you think about today's show. Goodbye for now.
This is for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You're welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Well, today this episode we are going to discuss hope from differing angles. We will try to focus on the concept of hope from the perspective of the Quran and ahadith or prophetic traditions. Believing in the resurrection day has a tremendous impact on reinforcing hope in us. It increases hope, it boosts hope in us. Having faith in the resurrection day reassures people that life is not limited to this world, obviously, but continues after death into another life where they can realize many of their wishes. Of course, we as human beings, you know, as Muslims, as people who believe in the day of resurrection, should believe that there is an eternal abode. And there is the place where we live perpetually, where we are going to be held responsible for our deeds. And if we are doing good deeds in this world, obviously we will be rewarded in the hereafter. We will be given rewards for whatever deeds we perform in this world. From the perspective of the Holy Quran also, true prosperity in the afterlife is eternal life, you know, eternal life. Now you can refer to chapter Ghafir, verse 39, where there is peace, tranquility, and absolute security. You can also refer to chapter Al-An'am, verse 127, and there are clear verses, there are clear indications based on which true prosperity and eternal life is in the afterworld, because that is the permanent abode, and therefore no insufficiency is found there. Everything is perfect in the afterworld. And of course, though people might have lived a desperate life in this world, reminiscence of God's blessings in the other world fades that out, since a believer hopes for comforts of the other world. You know, if we go through pain, if we go through difficulty and vicissitude and tribulation, we will definitely be rewarded in the hereafter, and we must pin our hope on God's mercy and on God's compassion in the afterworld. And if we have trust in Allah, if we keep having hope in Allah, then definitely we will have an easier life, a more comfortable life in this world. And also it is a tremendous effect on our life in the afterworld. And we do know for sure that the afterworld is a permanent world. It is a world where prosperity is guaranteed for those people who have hope in God and who do not despair of Allah's mercy. There is another aspect of, you know, having hope. We said that hope is an essential element of the Islamic education system, of course, and it is based on two aspects. One is cognitive aspect and the other is behavioral aspect. And behavioral approaches in the Holy Quran, of course, have been touched on, have been highlighted. And, you know, the behavioral approaches do have an impact on hope development and also on the reinforcement of hope. What does behavioral approach mean? Behavioral approach refer to practical procedures for developing and reinforcing hope in people. You know, These are solutions that focus on human behavior. I mean that behavioral approaches are solutions that focus on human behavior and on human practices in order to boost sincere and true hope.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
These solutions, which are based on the behavior and which come from the human behavior and man's behavioral approach, are categorized into individual and social modes, you know. When it comes to the individual mode or the individual solutions, of course, the first thing that is that's highly emphasized and that is highly stressed upon is remembering God or zikr. Zikr. Zikr is a very important concept. Zikr means to pay attention to God with language or heart, or both, you know, whether it is verbally or through heart, that means zikr, you know. Allah bi dhikri Allah tatmin al qulub, you know. This is an important verse of the Quran, which says that with the remembrance of Allah, the heart rests in peace, you know. So zikr actually is a particular state of mind where human beings consider God at that time. Whatever he does, he remembers God. He thinks that God is there. God is the witness. God sees him. And of course, prayer is one of the types of zikr. Prayer is one of the manifestations of zikr. From the viewpoint of Islam, the main cause of all anxieties and mental disorders of human beings these days is because they are forgetting God, because they are oblivious of God, and because they are not mindful of their duty to Allah. They are not God conscious, you know. You can refer to verse 65 of chapter Al-Asra, where you will find a verse related to the same concept. You know, the connection between the human soul and God originates from and lasts on the basis of remembering God. And there is no doubt about it. The Quran says, "Fathkuruni athkurkum, washkuruli wala takfurun." In fact, it is God who says, "Fathkuruni athkurkum." God says, "Remember me, and I will remember you." You know, chapter Al-Baqarah, verse 152. Remember me, I will remember you. Washkuruli, and be thankful to me. Wala takfurun, and don't be ungrateful. So, this verse of the Quran is very clear in its purport when it says "Fathkuruni." It means that you have to remember me, and dhikr is a duty, and it is an obligation upon mankind. Every individual has to fulfill his duty towards Allah by remembering him, and by constantly, doing dhikr, which, as I said, means to remember. Either using one's tongue or using or entertaining and being conscious of Allah. So, in fact, as I said, by remembering God, the hearts find peace. Allah bi dhikrillahi tatminul qulub. And of course, zikr has such an effect. If you remember God, of course, that your heart will definitely rest in peace. We will continue our discussion about hope in the following episode. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. All I need, all I need, all I need. Love is all I need.
In the limelight.
If the United States is ultimately allowed to extradite Assange and try him under the Espionage Act, it will send an ominous message to investigative journalists that they publish material critical of the U.S. government at their peril. This would threaten freedom of the press under the First Amendment and deprive the American people of crucial information with which to hold the government accountable. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Marjorie Kahn, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Threat of Extradition for Assange Grows Following British High Court Ruling. Stay tuned for more. On August 11th, in a rare occurrence, the UK High Court's Lord Justice Timothy Holyrood and Justice Dame Judith Farbey overruled the July 5th decision of Justice Jonathan Swift and allowed the Biden administration to add two additional grounds for its appeal against Julian Assange, who is being held on charges filed by the Trump administration under the Espionage Act. Assange was indicted for revealing evidence of U.S. war crimes in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo that Chelsea Manning furnished him and WikiLeaks. He faces 175 years in prison if he is extradited from the U.K., tried and convicted in the U.S. Just Swift had ruled that. The United States could base its appeals on three of the five grounds it requested. The August 11th ruling allows the U.S. to argue two additional grounds as well. The expansion of the U.S. appeal is a worrying sign for Assange and for the future of investigative journalism. In September 2020, a three-week extradition hearing was held in Assange case. On January 4th, UK District Court Judge Vanessa Beritzer issued her decision denying the Trump administration's request to extradite Assange to the U.S. to stand trial. Judge Beritzer ruled that Assange would be a high risk for suicide in light of his mental state and conditions under which he would be held in U.S. prisons. As Donald Trump was leaving office, his administration successfully petitioned the High Court for permission to appeal Judge Beritzer's ruling. Joe Biden should have dismissed Trump's appeal, consistent with the Obama-Biden administration refusal to indict Assange out of fear that indicting a journalist would imperil the First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of the press. No journalist or media outlet has been prosecuted under the Espionage Act for publishing truthful information. The First Amendment protects journalists who publish illegally obtained material that is a matter of public concern, including evidence of war crimes. The U.S. government has never prosecuted a journalist or media outlet for publishing classified information, which constitutes an essential tool of journalism. But Biden is doubling down and continuing Trump's appeal. When the United States appeal is heard on October 27th and 28th, the High Court may reweigh factual findings made by the district court judge, who was uniquely positioned to determine the credibility of the witness who testified at the extradition hearing. Five grounds on which the Biden administration is appealing the denial of extradition are as follows. Judge Barrett Sir committed legal error when she concluded that extradition would be unjust or oppressive due to Assange's mental or physical condition under Section 91 of the 2003 Extradition Act. Judge Barrett Sir should have notified the U.S. in order to provide it an opportunity to offer assurances to the court that Assange would not be subjected to conditions that imperiled his health and his life. Judge Barrett Sir should have excluded or assigned less weight to the evidence of defense psychiatric expert Professor Michael Koppelman regarding the severity of Assange's mental condition. Judge Barrett Sir committed error in her overall assessment of the evidence of suicide risk. On July 5th, the High Court allowed the U.S. to appeal on all but grounds 3 and 4. After the August 11th ruling, the U.S. is now permitted to appeal on all five grounds. Judge Barrett Sir relied largely, but not exclusively, on the evidence presented by psychiatric expert Michael Koppelman. In her January 4th ruling, Judge Barrett Sir wrote, "Koppelman assessed Ms. Assange during the period May to December 2019 and was best placed to consider at first hand his symptoms. He has taken great care to provide an informed account of Ms. Assange's background and psychiatric history. He has given close attention to the prison medical notes and provided a detailed summary annexed to his December report. He is an experienced clinician and he was well aware of the possibility of exaggeration and malingering. I had no reason to doubt his clinical option." Koppelman, an international authority on neuropsychiatry, evaluated Assange in prison and concluded that he was at severe risk of suicide if imprisoned in the U.S. Judge Barrett Sir cited Koppelman's statement, "I am as confident as a psychiatrist ever can be that if extradition to the U.S. were to become imminent, Ms. Assange will find a way of suiciding." She noted that other experts corroborated Koppelman's predictions of suicide. The United States is arguing on appeal that Judge Barrett Sir should have excluded Koppelman's evidence or given it less weight because he omitted from his December 2019 report that Assange had a partner, Stella Morris, and they had two young children together. Koppelman knew about them but was concerned about Morris' anxiety about the privacy of her children. Both Koppelman's subsequent report in August 2020 and his testimony at the September 2020 extradition hearing referred to Morris and their children. By then, it had become public knowledge. Judge Barrett Sir considered Koppelman's two reports as well as his testimony before rendering her January 4th ruling. She acknowledged the initial concealment but excused it. Writing, "I did not accept that Professor Koppelman failed in his duty to the court when I did not disclose Ms. Morris' relationship with Assange. In my judgment, Professor Koppelman's decision to conceal their relationship was misleading and inappropriate in the context of his obligations to the court. But an understandable human response to Ms. Morris' predicament, in short, I found Professor Koppelman's opinion to be impartial and dispassionate." The United States is presenting assurances that if Assange is extradited to the U.S., tried, convicted, and imprisoned, he will not be subject to special administrative measures, which are onerous conditions that would keep him in virtual isolation or be held at the ADX Maximum Security Prison in Florence, Colorado. These so-called assurances are conditional, however. The U.S. reserves the right to impose SAMs or hold Assange at ADX if future behavior warrants it. And the U.S. cannot guarantee that Australia would consent to host Assange incarceration. The U.S. is arguing that Judge Barrister should have told them during the extradition hearing that she intended to refuse extradition based on Assange's life and health if imprisoned in the U.S. They would then have presented assurances at that time, but their current proffer amounts to new evidence that should have been submitted at the extradition hearing. In October, the High Court, during the appeal hearing, will consider the grounds that the U.S. is raising on appeal and determine whether to sustain or overrule Judge Barrister's decision denying extradition. If the High Court affirms the district court ruling, the United States could ask the U.K. Supreme Court to review the case. If the High Court overrules the district court decision, Assange could appeal to the Supreme Court and then to the European Court of Human Rights if the Supreme Court ruling goes against him. If the United States is ultimately allowed to extradite Assange and try him under the Espionage Act, it will send an ominous message to investigative journalists that they publish material critical of the U.S. government at their peril. This would threaten freedom of the press under the First Amendment and deprive the American people of crucial information with which to hold their government accountable.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. Today's lesson, the objectification of human beings. The issue of objectification of human beings has long been criticized as a problem in Western societies, especially as it relates to the treatment of women. Scholars from different disciplines have identified objectification as a dehumanizing process whereby human beings are treated as objects rather than people. How does it really happen? Well, first, it occurs through socialization, or in other words, through the norms, expectations, and cultural values that are passed on to girls in various ways, including through media. When sexualized representations of women and girls are institutionalized in the cultural fabric of a society, sexualization will be seen as an accepted norm. Interpersonal relationships are the second venue for sexualization in society. When family members, peers, and other people around you and around in the society treat girls and women in sexualized ways. Thirdly, the sexualization becomes an entrenched part of a society when self-sexualization or self-objectification becomes parts of women's lived experience, so that it turns into an inseparable aspect of their identity and self-image. This third point, this last point, needs a little bit more clarification and explanation, which we will get to after the break.
Why السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله
وعلى أرواح.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about the objectification of human beings. And we said that there are several ways through which this objectification and this sexualization of human beings and overall generally a society takes place. The third point that we mentioned, it needs a little bit more explanation. So take this. When girls learn that not only are sexualized appearance and behavior approved or accepted by society and important people in their lives, such as their peers, their friends, but also are rewarded in important ways, such as in job success, the likelihood of the internalization or cultivation of such a value increases. This is where self-sexualization or self-objectification also occurs. In a special report on the problem of sexualization of girls, the American Psychological Association considers the cultural factors that affect the occurrence of this problem in the United States of America to be very comprehensive, so that women and girls are far more sexually objectified than men in all kinds of media, including television, magazines, news media, and music videos. Likewise, this is found to be a pervasive feature of commercial advertising and commodity markets, especially those of clothing, toys, and cosmetics. So, brothers and sisters, we know that Islam has provided us for, like we mentioned previously, a holistic system which does not view a man or a woman as a sex object. It does not view a man or a woman as an object. Instead, they are looked at as a human, the human which is headed towards and moving towards its spiritual and physical perfection, which is also defined by Islam. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
But anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence fills the air.
In the limelight.
For most of the last week, in the fires of the worst foreign policy crisis of his young administration, the president who won the White House on a promise of competence and compassion has had trouble demonstrating much of either. The chaos in Kabul and his own conflicting message have left President Biden struggling to assert command over world events and seemingly more intent on washing his hands of Afghanistan than expressing concern over the humanitarian tragedy unfolding in the country. The article you're about to hear has been written by Peter Baker, the chief White House correspondent for the New York Times. The piece is titled, Biden Ran on Competence and Empathy, Afghanistan is Testing That. East of the last week in defiance of the worst foreign policy crisis of his young administration, the president who won the White House on a promise of competence and compassion has had trouble demonstrating much of either. The chaos in Kabul and his own conflicting messages have left President Biden struggling to assert command over world events and seemingly more intent on washing his hands of Afghanistan than expressing concern over the humanitarian tragedy unfolding in the country. Mr. Biden's team argues that it will not matter in the long run because Americans agree with his decision to pull out after 20 years of war and do not care what happens in Afghanistan as long as their fellow citizens are extracted safely. Afghanistan is America's longest war, stretching through four presidencies, and none of those presidents found a way to disengage successfully. But the tumultuous endgame of President Biden's withdrawal has nonetheless undercut some of the most fundamental premises of Mr. Biden's presidency. That, unlike his erratic, self-absorbed predecessor, he brought foreign policy seasoning, adults in the room judgment, and a surfeit of empathy to the Oval Office. I just had the feeling that he was so wrapped up in the decision itself that he forgot the basics of implementation, said Leon Panetta, the former defense secretary who served alongside Joe Biden in President Barack Obama's administration. The American people may be with you on that decision, but if they see chaos in Afghanistan, they're going to be very concerned that the president doesn't have his act together. David Axelrod, a former strategist for Barack Obama, said he had no doubt that most Americans agreed with Joe Biden that it was time to wrap up the Afghanistan operation. The way it's ending, at least thus far, is more problematical, he said, and cuts against some of his core perceived strengths: competence, mastery of foreign policy, and empathy. It's as if his eagerness to end the war in Afghanistan overran the planning and execution. After days of withering criticism from allies as well as adversaries, Mr. Biden tried to repair some of the damage on Friday, 20th of August, with a half-hour appearance in the East Room of the White House, where he asserted that the evacuation operation had made significant progress, while acknowledging that images of desperate Afghans chasing planes and handing a baby over barbed wire have been heartbreaking and gut-wrenching. Faulted earlier in the week for not consulting with allies, Joe Biden made a point of noting that he had now called the leaders of Britain, Germany, and France. Mocked for spending time at Camp David, where he had gone for summer break, while Afghanistan fell to the Taliban, Joe Biden delayed plans to fly Friday afternoon to his home in Wilmington, Delaware, until Saturday, 21st of August. Leon Panetta said Joe Biden seemed to have realized that he had mishandled the message, at least, and needed to make adjustments. I just had a sense that he was back on his feet today as opposed to earlier in the week, Panetta said. Beyond repeating that, the buck stops with me, however, President Biden conceded no mistakes of his own and again deflected the harsh reviews by focusing on his desire to end the war in Afghanistan rather than directly addressing what many consider the botched execution of that decision. There will be plenty of time to criticize and second-guess when this operation is over, Biden said. But now, I'm focused on getting that job done. As he has all week, President Biden made assertions seemingly at odds with reality. His description of a smoother evacuation contrasted with a continuing confusion at Kabul airport, where flights were halted for hours on Friday, 20th of August, until they resumed later on in the day. His claims that there was no question about credibility with NATO allies belied the deep frustration in European capitals. And while President Biden held the degree of precision of the operation, he could not say how many Americans were still in danger. Those comments came after other suspect statements earlier in the week, a month after he said it was, quote, highly unlikely, unquote, the Taliban would take over Afghanistan and there was no circumstance that would lead to a chaotic Saigon-like exit. President Biden told George Stephanopoulos of ABC News this week that chaos was in fact always inevitable. While multiple reports indicated that military leaders argued to keep a small force in Afghanistan rather than pull out entirely, Joe Biden insisted that no one said that to me that I can recall. At points, the president has evinced little sense of the human toll as the Taliban swept back to power in Kabul. Asked about pictures of fleeing Afghans packed into planes and some even falling to their deaths after trying to sneak aboard, Joe Biden interrupted. That was 4 days ago, 5 days ago, he said, when in fact it was just 2 days earlier and hardly made less horrific by the passage of a couple of sunsets. While largely disavowing any errors, Joe Biden instead has pointed the finger D, the now deposed Afghan government, the vanishing Afghan security forces, and even Afghan civilians who he said resisted being evacuated earlier. He has avoided blaming the Taliban, presumably to avoid antagonizing them whilst executing the evacuation. Losing the public perception of basic competence can be hazardous for a presidency. George W. Bush certainly learned that during the mishandled response to Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Donald J. Trump critics never considered him particularly apt in office, but his handling of the coronavirus pandemic certainly undermined him further. Joe Biden's stumbles have been particularly striking given the longtime senator and former vice president brought more experience in national and international affairs to the White House than any newly inaugurated president in more than three decades. But his aides maintained that Americans will look beyond the turmoil of recent days to the bigger picture. What Americans are seeing is a president who has the courage of his conviction that this is the right decision for our country, even when that decision is hard, said Kate Bedingfield, the White House communications director. They are seeing a president who promised to end America's longest war and kept his word, and who takes responsibility when things don't go perfectly because the buck stops with him. The Biden team's cold political calculation is that the outrage expressed by the Washington political class and the ghastly images shown by the national news media will have little lasting effect on Americans, who will soon forget the messy departure, but remember that the president got the United States out of a failed war. They may be right. By Friday, newspapers in places like Phoenix, Fresno, Jacksonville, Minneapolis, and Providence had no stories about Afghanistan on their front pages. Americans historically have not voted much on foreign policy unless it directly involves Americans, which is why Joe Biden's main priority has been to get his own citizens out of Afghanistan without casualties or a hostage situation. Biden thinks he gets away with this as long as there are no Americans that are killed on the ground, which is a big if, because a lot of things could go wrong, said Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, a geopolitical risk firm. Ian Bremmer added, "But I happen to agree with him. I think that's right." At the same time, he added, "I'm amazed at how he's mishandled this with the allies." The political danger for President Biden may be that the chaotic exit from Afghanistan provides fodder for a broader Republican argument that he's not up to the job and has left the United States humiliated on the world stage. The pictures of bedlam are like political manna for campaign advertisement makers, with no doubt will try to paint Joe Biden as another Jimmy Carter. Some of those who have criticized Joe Biden nonetheless said that the final verdict was yet to be written. It will hinge, they said, on whether he can ensure the safety not just of Americans trying to leave the country, but also the Afghans who worked with the United States over the past two decades, even if it takes longer than Joe Biden's 31st of August deadline. The president still has a lot of agency over how this will be perceived and the impact of our reputation for compassion and competence, said Representative Tom Malinowski, a Democrat from New Jersey. Malinowski added, "It all depends on whether he's willing to do what it takes and to allow our military to do what it's capable of doing. That chapter, of course, will be written over the next few days and weeks."
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
March 18, 2002. The prophets save humans. So in the Quran, one important purpose of prophethood is said to be establishing justice. We sent our messengers with clear evidence to support their truthfulness, and sent with them the book and the balance so that people would maintain justice. Quran, chapter 57, verse 25. In fact, the divine books and the prophets were sent in order for justice to be established in societies, that is, to remove the symbols of oppression, coercion, and corruption. The movement of Imam Hussein was a movement of such nature. He said, "I rose up to reform the Muslim community of my grandfather, Prophet Muhammad." He also said, "Whoever observes a ruler legalizes what God has made unlawful, violating the covenant of God, opposing the sunnah of the Messenger of God, and treating the creatures of God sinfully and oppressively, he who does not oppose him with his speech and action, God has a right to bring him to the same fate as that of the tyrant."
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latsham, ana latsham,
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
That is, if a person sees where corruption and oppression emerge from, yet they do not do anything to oppose the source of corruption and oppression for God the Exalted, they have the same fate as the corrupt oppressor. He said that he did not rise up for the cause of wickedness, amusement, corruption, or oppression. The people of Iraq invited Imam Hussein to rule over them, and Imam Hussein answered their request. So it is not that Imam Hussein did not think of creating a government. He was indeed thinking of overturning tyrannical powers, either by taking the government away from them or by martyrdom. Imam Hussein knew what would his silence, his endorsement, and his indifference would do to Islam if he did not take any action. When a power takes all the capacities of a community or some communities under control and acts tyrannically, if the men of truth do not oppose him, refuting his actions, they have actually endorsed his actions. That is, oppression is endorsed by the men of truth without them really wanting it.
Turkey says it will decide on Taliban's government recognition after it is formed. Turkish foreign minister said Ankara will not rush into recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan as it is still too early for this step.
We are keeping up dialogue with all sides, including the Taliban. We view positively the messages that the Taliban have given so far, whether to foreigners, diplomatic individuals, or its own people. We hope to see these in action as well.
In response to a question regarding Turkey's contact with the Taliban, Çavuşoğlu said Turkey had invited the political wing of the Taliban to Turkey before they had entered Kabul. Earlier, Turkish security sources said Ankara had dropped plans to guard and operate Kabul's airport after the withdrawal of NATO forces from Afghanistan, following footage and reports of chaos taking place there after Taliban's takeover. Turkey says its offer to provide technical and security assistance at the Kabul airport will be further discussed with the U.S.
Turkey will follow the lead of other countries in recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan. If the U.S. and EU countries recognize a government formed by Taliban, Turkey will follow in their footsteps. However, I don't think that Turkey will consider the Taliban government as a strategic partner in the region. We expect a delegation from the Taliban to visit Turkey for talks over the transition phase, just like it is taking place with other countries in the region.
The Turkish president had announced last week his readiness to meet with the Taliban leadership. Turkey says so far the Taliban is sending positive messages, hoping that it will be followed with positive actions as well. Turkey is now concerned about the refugee influx it is going to have after Taliban's takeover in Afghanistan. This comes as it has been struggling to revive the economic situation in the country, with a handful of refugees already there amid the coronavirus pandemic. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, dressed in black, marched along major streets beating their chests in mourning over the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, his household, and his loyal companions in Karbala in present-day Iraq. The army of Yazid conducted the massacre in the most brutal manner.
They have shown merciless act there in that field, in which Imam Hussein and his whole household, his sahabas, in which they believe in him, and even babies in which they have been born, they have been killed.
Members of the Islamic movement said the Ashura is a time for sorrow and is a time for self-reflection when one commits oneself completely to the mourning of Imam Hussein. They said commemorating the martyrdom in Karbala signifies the ultimate prize in the pursuit of justice and righteousness.
The Ashura teaching, it teaches us to be, at least to be honest in all our believing, to commit all our faith to Almighty Allah. We should not fear any creator in this earth if we want to fulfill our promise to be a good Muslim or to practice the religion of our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his descendants the way it is.
According to the Islamic movement, the Ashura processions were conducted peacefully in many Nigerian cities. However, they said two people were killed in the northwestern Nigerian state of Sokoto, where the Nigeria police attacked the procession with live rounds. Danjuma Abdullahi, Suleja.
The 10th day of Muharram has been a day of mourning and commemoration of the martyrdom of the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, Hussein ibn Ali, also in Italy. Faithfuls from across the Italian peninsula met at Rome's Imam Mahdi Islamic Center to honor the Battle of Karbala and remember the sacrifices of the Imam Hussein, whose death is considered a symbol of the struggle against tyranny and injustice.
I have goosebumps when Ashura comes, and I move to tears when I listen to Imam Hussein's words. I always take my children to the Ashura ceremonies. I want them to understand what Imam Hussein did for us.
Ashura is everything to me. Ashura is death, rebirth, life. We have to follow Imam Hussein's example, the way he stood against his enemies, who were nothing but traitors.
The Ashura commemoration at the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center has been attended by Shia Muslims coming from a number of countries, including Afghanistan, Iran, Syria, India, and Moldavia.
Many at the Imam Mahdi Center here in Rome believe Ashura is not just a day in history. They are of the idea that Iran's consistency in resisting hegemony is rooted precisely in the culture of Ashura.
Our resistance to hegemonic plans is great thanks to the legacy of Imam Hussein. Active opposition to hegemony is possible through resistance at the level of everyday life. In fact, our faith reflects a model that can serve all societies.
Celebration at the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center have included performing tajiyeh, cooking various kinds of food and distributing it among the attendants, and a final speech by Sheikh Abbas Di Palma, in which he remembered the Battle of Karbala and the attack and the killing of Imam Hussein. Max Civili, Rome.
Video was filmed on Ashura Day inside the Sukaina Shrine in Daraya in Damascus countryside before the war in Syria started. Mourners used to peacefully mark the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. However, the site nowadays is in a totally different situation. Terrorists occupied and used the shrine as a stronghold during the clashes that happened there, gradually causing its destruction.
Terrorists are implementing a global and intelligence plot. They target our symbols and try to destroy them. For example, in Raqqa, they destroyed the shrine of a symbol of Siffin battle, Sayyid Ammar bin Yasser, and in Damascus, Sayyida Sukaina. They want to break the morale of resistance supporters.
Those images are seen by Syrians as an interpretation of what the followers of oppressors and tyrants of our time want for Islam, which are